This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Nico, my son, remembers last year when we rooted for the Cardinals in the World Series, and he refuses to be a Nationals fan. He's a Cardinals fan. I do worry this is eventually going to get him beat up.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the RG3 of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Mike, that's high praise here in Washington, babe.
Hey, baby. This is the Washington Redskins quarterback who ran, 78 yards for a touchdown?
The guy's like a monster. He's taken a coach who had gone like 11-21 in his first 2 years,
yeah,
who hasn't, I think, won one playoff game in the last 13-14 years since Elway retired, and he's making them look like a real team. The guy's got serious game.
But the record's still pretty bad, though, right?
They're 3-3.
Oh, okay. That's not
It's the same
bad.
As my New England Patriots have been playing like choking dogs.
All right. There you go. Now, see, in D.C., we're quick to change the conversation after the sad loss that the Nationals had.
Oof.
Great season. They got beat. But I got to say, St. Louis Cardinals, that is my team, grew up in St. Louis. And Nico, my son, remembers last year when we rooted for the Cardinals in the World Series, and he refuses to be a Nationals fan. He's a Cardinals fan. I do worry this is eventually going to get him beat up. All right, Rick, good to have you back on the show. Lots of stuff happening in the education reform world.
Mm.
Including, by the way, that my book is out.
Yes, with big coverage in the Washington Post, I believe.
Nice article in the Washington Post. Yes, featuring me as that white guy who gentrified D.C. and then sold out.
By star reporter Lindsay Layton.
That's right.
You got top shelf treatment, baby.
It was nice. You know, we weren't planning on coming out with the book quite yet, but hey, if the Post wants to run an article, you just got to go with it. So, it is available for sale at Amazon or on Kindle, in case people are interested.
Are you going to interview yourself for the Ed Next book review?
I was thinking about it, actually. I was thinking about doing exactly that.
That'd be kind of fun.
All right, Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
The states deserve to take heat for setting different proficiency standards for students of different races and ethnicities.
So, Rick, this has been a big debate. Florida has gotten a lot of heat for this, but other states are doing this, too. The president was asked about this at Education Nation. He said, doesn't it make you angry that these states are setting different goals for minority kids than for white kids? Does it make you angry, Rick?
I believe all children can learn.
Boom. Boom. All right. So is this is achievement gap mania, right?
I believe all children can learn. We ought to expect every child to be proficient on these things.
Yes.
We should not have these differential goals. Ought to be 100% across the board. Let's be serious.
By 2014.
By 2013. I believe all children can learn.
All right. Okay.
You see why people like doing that. You see, it's got rhetorical power.
No, it absolutely
Mike,
does.
Do you believe all children can't learn?
No, because I practice the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what states have done is they've said, look, we're going to look at where these different student populations are today. We're going to ask them all to make good progress, and we're going to see where that leaves us. And guess what? There's huge gaps, especially in states that have set the bar for proficiency at all high. And so they're, even if African-American kids and Latino kids make huge progress, but not, you know, they still are not going to reach where the white kids are within 5 years. People are up in arms about states admitting the truth.
Mm. Don't you think states ought to have one bar for children, whether
Rick,
or not they're
Rick,
white or black?
Rick, you're not playing along here. Come on now.
I've decided that I am sick to death of being on the side of nuance. It's a hell of a lot more fun here. I want to be on the side of the right. And I'm saying, look, I believe all children can learn.
Mm-hmm.
I believe all children can learn whatever their skin color or poverty status. Mm-hmm. And I want to know why you don't think so.
All right. You are out of step with the president who said at Education.
There's Nation, a shocker.
He says, I am angry about this. He said, however, we've got to set goals that are achievable. And something about the fact that the point is states need to make progress over time. That's exactly the right line. I mean, of course, we're all, you know, none of us like the fact that there are these huge achievement gaps and we are working hard in narrowing them. The point of accountability systems should be to motivate schools to make strong progress, even heroic progress. But if we set goals in a way that they can't possibly reach and then say we're going to do bad things to schools that don't meet them, that's not only unfair, it's demoralizing.
Mm.
So there you have it. You heard it here first, not from Rick, who just likes
Mike Petrilli, champion of disparate expectations for children based on skin color.
You heard it here first. Okay, topic number two.
As Rick said, the Washington Post recently previewed your new book, Mike, on what you call the diverse schools dilemma. Do you think middle-class urban families should be sending their kids to inner-city public schools?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, what I try to do in the book, though, is provide all the pros and the cons so that parents can make this decision informed. And there are some strong pros, no doubt. I think that that there's huge benefits. Parents talk about it, about having kids experience this diversity, that the kids are going to grow up in a very diverse country, and so getting exposure early is good. And they also talk about, you know, look, at our job as parents is not to shield our kids from every experience that might be challenging. It could be challenging to go to school with kids who are poor, but that can be a good thing. On the other hand, schools that have a very diverse student population, especially in terms of socioeconomics, tend to have a very diverse schools academically. Kids who are way behind, other kids who are way ahead. It takes a special school to be able to deal with that well. It's also hard to find many of these diverse schools that are all that educationally progressive. So if you want something on the Waldorf, Montessori side, project-based, it's really hard to find those kinds of schools out there that are also diverse. So often you have to choose. If you're going to choose a diverse school, it's going to be more on the traditional side of the spectrum.
Well, what do we mean by diversity, Mike?
Well, in the book, I'm really talking about socioeconomic diversity. So I'm talking about schools that serve both affluent kids and poor kids. And, you know, I get into this a little bit in the book. Basically, schools that, let's say, are at least 20% free and reduced price lunch, higher than 50%, you're talking about a high poverty school. And we already know that most middle class parents just don't even consider those schools at all. So it's really in that 20% to 50%.
Are they wrong to not consider those high poverty schools?
Well, you know, Rick Kallenberg in my book says that basically he tells parents, yeah, don't consider them. I mean, that those schools are you know, where there's concentrated poverty, they're not good for anybody, not for the poor kids, not for the affluent kids. Now, there are always exceptions. There might be schools on the border there but that if you have a high concentration of poor kids, certainly above 50%, it makes it a lot of things more challenging. So, and in the D.C. metro area, Rick, I did some calculations. Less than 3% of white kids attend schools that are more than 50% poor. And I think some of those were out in the suburbs in West Virginia. It's just, you know, middle-class parents tend to say, okay, well, we'll consider schools that are 20, 30, 40%, much above that. They're not even considering it. So the parents I'm talking to are considering the schools in those kinds of ranges.
I mean, but given what we know about peer effects, given what we know about, look, that kids from low-income households generally are going to have been less likely to get read to as little
right.
kids,
right.
less likely to have households that report on surveys that they place an emphasis on schoolwork. Yep. Why isn't the responsible middle-class parent trying to get their kid in a school with as small a poverty population as possible?
Well, I mean, I write about that in the book, that if your goal is academic acceleration, you know, for your kids to basically learn as much content as possible, that's probably the way to go, is to get them around peers that are as, you know, come from well-educated families and who, you know, are ready to go as fast as possible. But there's conflicting values, and some parents, you know, there's a lot of value in the other stuff. And to be honest, Rick, the other thing is a lot of parents today want to live in the city, and the schools in the city are diverse. And so the question is not so much, you know, do I want to choose a diverse school, as can I make this diverse school that's the one down the street work for me, because it's the one I can afford, because it's where I want to live. And so it's more of a threshold question, I think, for a lot of parents.
So you suggested that 50% is probably too, you know, not the threshold. What is the threshold?
Say this
again. What percentage of children in poverty at a school kind of is the threshold where you would say to a middle-class parent, hey, this is a school that I would encourage you to feel fine about sending your kid to?
Yeah, I mean, I think anything below 50% would be fine for lots of parents, but there's trade-offs. I mean, as you write about all the time, and as I write about in the book, the key is trade-offs and really clarifying the pros and the cons, and then every parent's got to make a decision on their own. As the article in the Post stressed, and as I have taken plenty of heat for in the comments section, in the end, I decided to sell out and to move to Bethesda, where my son will go to what is literally the whitest school in Montgomery County. Didn't do that on purpose, but that's the nature of where we live now. That's one decision. Other parents have chosen diverse schools, and they've had a great experience. So I think it's a matter of trade-offs.
Hmm.
So by the way, Rick, the obvious sequel to this book is, you know what? Smarty pants.
Absolutely.
Yep. What were we going to call this one? How to get your kid a great education without breaking the bank?
is more timely than ever.
All right, we got to get on that. All right, topic number three.
France's president recently pledged to ban homework. Should American schools follow suit?
I love this one. What do you think, Rick?
I mean, I need a little definitional help. When children read books at home, is that homework? So does he want to discourage kids from reading books after school hours?
I think that would lead to inequalities because he assumes that the only kids that will read books at home would be the kids from more affluent backgrounds.
So when we're banning homework, I actually don't know what the case is in France. Certainly in the States, teachers will routinely ask kids to read a couple of books during the summer off a summer reading list.
Mm-hmm.
Does the French president want to prohibit that practice?
All right. So what his argument is here is that kids coming from low-income homes don't have what they need at home to do the homework. Their parents aren't focused on this. Mm-hmm. They don't have home environment. So he's saying we should just design our schools so that the kids stay longer at school and get everything done they need to get done there and not expect learning to happen after school.
So I'll repeat my question. Does that mean that he wants teachers to not encourage kids to read books
Let's assume he does. I mean, this is crazy, right? This takes the equity issue to...
This takes achievement gap mania to new depths. Yeah. I mean, how insane is it that the president of a nation would think it is a problem to encourage kids to learn and master content away from school, right? Because every single child won't.
Right. I mean, this is where you end up if you say, look, the goal is just equal outcomes. You get to these arguments for leveling down. And you say what we need to do is find different ways for the kids with more advantages to tie their hands behind their backs. And look, I mean, there's a lot of educational ideas out there that would do that quite effectively.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem crazy. And, you know, one argument from our perspective is, hey, let France do this. We're going to look better than them in the TIMSS and the PISA coming up, right?
I'm less concerned about that. We're actually going to have kids who are able to invent things and build things and do things and make it a better world.
Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Are you still in mourning over your Washington Nationals?
Yeah, and the Orioles, both of our local teams out of there.
Hey, but the Redskins won?
Redskins came back. RG3, baby!
RG3, that's right. And as I said earlier, Rick Hess is the RG3 of the education policy. I mean, I think that really fits.
Yes, he is.
You know, he's got lots of different skills. Ooh. He can throw, he can pass, he can run.
Yeah, comes out punching and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So on.
Although RG3, when he's working, always wears pants.
Yes.
So there's...
And RG3 is pretty polite, too, in interviews. And the Rickster can, he can be a zinger sometimes.
Wow. When you are less polite than a professional athlete, that is really saying something, isn't it?
I think he had a military background, right? His dad was a military guy. Yeah, RG3. Oh, cool. Not Rick's, but...
Excellent.
RG3.
Really? Did he go to the Department of Defense schools? We should look into that.
I know. We should.
Those DOD schools producing a lot of great folks. Okay. I understand that we are, again, struggling here. Let me make a plea out here to the country's education researchers and research shops.
Okay? All 15 of them listening, please.
It's not a problem to release studies during an election, okay? There are people who write stories not about the election. Okay, so next year, in 2016, Amber, can we remember we should release tons of big studies
right?
They would get covered.
Right. They would, because it's just bad. It's bad out there. I looked everywhere, but lo and behold, I found some slightly related to education study.
Well, that is only a research minute. Okay, make it fast.
I know. All right. I know. I need to cut some of this out. So Urban Institute decided to look at spending in terms of how much we spend on kids by age group, with the underlying premise that, you know, we're supposed to be spending presumably on kids in the early grades because we need to give these kids a better shot in life. So they looked at federal spending at 0 to 3 to 5, 6 to 11, and 12 to 18. Okay, in 2008, before the recession, and then they looked again in 2011.
And this is more than just schools. This is everything?
That's right. Everything. I mean, all sources like Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And hold on. So they examined federal, state, and local spending in 2008. So that was where we had the most recent data for all the sources. And so they found that federal expenditures on children totaled approximately $445 billion in 2011, 85% from direct spending on federal programs. So this is Medicaid, food stamps, Title I, etc. Mm-hmm. About 15% from reduction in taxes, so the earned income tax credit, dependent exemptions, child tax credit, so on. Federal expenditures per child in 2011 were highest for infants and toddlers. We kind of knew that. Decreases with age, which you'd expect, mostly because Medicaid spends more on infants and toddlers than any other age group. More young children and poorer families than older kids receiving food stamps and so on and so forth. So the Recovery Act, they kind of looked at kind of what that did, and they discovered that the feds, that targeted spending to early childhood. We know that federal expenditures per child in 2011 were highest for infants and toddlers and decreased with age because most of those kids are benefiting from Medicaid and these other programs. But they also, we also know that the feds target spending to early childhood since the older kids, you know, that funding is being funded by states and localities. As kids get older, that's where the state and local funding is coming in. So in 2011, Fed expenditures grew by 27% for the youngest children. So as a result of the stimulus, 19% for ages 3 through 5 and 16% for students older than 5. They found that the stimulus funds were mostly targeted to those school-age kids via Title I and special education programs. Federal, state, and local funding combined is higher for older kids, about $14,000 per capita, and just $5,400 for kids 0 to 2. So you really do see the differences between those really young kids. Finally, as a result of spending, and we've heard this before, the shift, the share of federal spending and the state and local share kind of shifted. So local and states threw in about 68% of all public spending in 2008. That was down to 61% in 2011.
So that's interesting. So, okay, so what you're saying is the federal policy seems to make sense, more spending on the young. When you add everything up, though, however, we do spend a lot more on the teenagers than we do on the babies.
That's right.
And that's really because of schools.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
We're paying, as the public, we're paying full freight for the cost of educating high school kids, which is relatively expensive. We are not paying the full cost of, say, childcare for babies generally or other costs like that.
That's right.
It's also interesting in that I think we know that, you know, especially when you're looking at a low-income population, those families are poorest when they've got little kids.
Yes,
and as
right.
they get older, they tend to make a little more money.
And
so that does seem to be raise some questions about whether this makes sense.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
You know, I mean, here's the question, Amber. I mean, the broader Boulder folks have always been saying we should be doing more on early childhood, on, on the broader, you know, health stuff. You could say, look, okay, then what we should do is spend less on K-12 education and more on those other things if we have to set priorities. I mean, aren't they making an argument for basically taking money out of the K-12 system?
Yeah, they kind of are.
Yeah.
And I think that this research, I mean, although it didn't come out and say it, it kept coming back to that. You know, is this the right formula? You know, are these shares right? You know, given the research on, you know, giving kids a head start, you know, and 0 to 2, 0 to 3, those are critical ages and so on and so forth. Another little factoid, which you're probably going to guess this, but what percentage of you think of federal public spending, I'm saying, comes from the feds for elderly? So in other words, what percentage of local and state versus federal subsidies for elderly?
How I would think that the feds paid 90% of the bill.
95%, even higher than I thought.
Yeah, because of Medicare and Social Security.
Yeah,
sure.
That's right.
So very different traditions when it comes to caring for the young. Fascinating. All right, Amber. See, I didn't think that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I dug, and yeah, it wasn't as bad as, you know, one week I did the. Well, we won't talk about that.
All right. Well, good. Okay, Amber. Well, hey, maybe next week someone will take our advice. Get some guts.
Send
release
a study.
We have a big, huge study coming out week before the election, right?
Woohoo, big time.
So we're not afraid.
Nope.
Okay, we're
October
saying,
29th.
Hey, an election? What election? All right, we will go toe-to-toe with that election.
Yes, we will.
All right, good.
We'll see
how
that works out for us.
Thanks, as always, Amber. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.